Hello, everybody. Welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell in the studio with Russ Chianelli and a good old friend called Donald Moss, Don Moss, Professor Don Moss, Professor Emeritus from the Department of Psychology here at the University of Texas in El Paso. And he's really well known around this campus because for 30 years or more, he's been championing a particular treatment for Alzheimer's, which has got a lot of attention but hasn't really moved forward to the degree perhaps it should have done. And we're going to learn all about this from Don. So, Don, welcome very much to Science Studio again.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This is the third time over 30-odd years that you've been on. And every time there's something new to learn. And so we're going to learn a lot. But before we get into the business of the drug that you concocted or perfected or used, tell us a little. Tell us a little bit about
not concocted. Alzheimer's.
Sorry,
not concocted.
Well, it is. I mean, that's what chemists do. Anyway, before we get into that particular aspect, tell us in simple terms, because I'm getting old. Russ has got old, and you know, we don't know the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's, and it seems to me age is something where dementia begins to happen regardless of how perfectly you've lived your life. So what's the distinctions?
Well, it is true that as we grow older, we lose cognitive ability and memory, and there is common misunderstanding about what might be called age-related memory impairment, normal age-related loss, and Alzheimer's disease. But Alzheimer's disease is a organic process in the brain. It's a very specific disease process that generates the senile plaque, the amyloid plaque, and neurofibrillary tangles. It's a very well-defined, specific disease, and it destroys the area of the brain, the areas of the brain that are involved in memory and cognitive processes, and so that's why it's in dementia. But there are other sources of dementia. Alzheimer's makes up about two-thirds of dementia in old age, but it is different from normal age-related memory impairment. That's usually pretty benign. You just slip along and your memory gets worse and worse. You forget where you put your keys, and you can live with normal age-related memory impairment.
Well, I mean, but does that not progress and become, for example, I mean, the classic case of an Alzheimer's patient, as I worried about it in my own family, is when somebody gets up in the morning, goes out to the shop and gets lost, doesn't know how to get home, because now that is automatically then classified, once you know it, as Alzheimer's. That wouldn't happen in regular dementia?
That's classified as dementia.
Right.
That's where you've lost the ability to do everyday things. And it's a permanent loss. It's not a temporary confusion, and it's not the result of being intoxicated with some poison or something. But there are other kinds of dementia, multiple infarct dementia, where you suffer from a series of small strokes. And there's normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is a problem with the way the liquid circulates around the brain and causes brain malfunction. You can have a vitamin B12 deficiency. You can have brain tumors. There are all kinds of things that can cause this kind of a loss, where you walk out your house to go someplace familiar and get lost. However, getting lost is really a classic symptom of Alzheimer's. It happens with other types of dementia.
Well, those other types of dementia, though, you mentioned that three or four of them, they're all things that can be tested for, it seems to me.
Well, yes, multiple infarct dementia, you can test for that, normal pressure hydrocephalus. Those things are treatable. That's why if you begin to have severe memory problems, something that really bothers you, you should go to a neurologist, someone who is familiar with dementia, somebody that specializes in the brain.
And so the thought there is that you might be lucky enough to have some form of dementia that is not Alzheimer's disease.
That's right, because so far Alzheimer's disease is not really treatable effectively, but other things are.
The other thing about Alzheimer's, you only know you've had it once they cut your brain open to investigate more.
Well, that's true. The only way to know for absolute certainty is to get an autopsy of the brain where they go in and they find on microscopic examination of the brain tissue that you have the characteristic amyloid plaque and neurofibrillary tangles. But you can be clinically diagnosed pretty thoroughly before you die, and that is if you have a disease that is gradual in onset and it doesn't progress in steps. You don't go from one day being okay to one day being totally confused. That clinically is more like multiple infarct dementia where you have a little stroke now and then. And you follow all these other steps of eliminating alternatives. At the end of that, a good workup, you can probably be about 90% sure that you have Alzheimer's disease or not.
Okay. But there's no way to do an MRI of the brain and see these little tangles? And
they're getting to the point where they can.
Oh, really?
Yes, but that's only for research, and that is very, very expensive. But they can get positron emission tomography that shows they have a positron emitter that binds to the amyloid and that kind of thing, and they can measure it. But it's not something that the everyday person would be able to do.
No, but MRIs weren't when they began, right? I mean, the point being
yes.
that this is going to be progressively cheaper and cheaper, especially as
yes.
the age of the politicians with the money gets older and older, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. Well, tell us now, your journey. Some of the listeners might remember it, but let's start from the beginning. You came over to the chemistry department, talked to my good friend Bill Herndon many years ago.
Eastman at one time, too.
And Mike Eastman, and then Steve Vincenti.
Steve Vincenti did a lot of work with me. Yeah.
And you wanted this molecule, MSF. Tell us what was behind you coming over to the chemist and saying, hey, we want this material.
Well, methane sulfonyl fluoride, or MSF, is the drug that I would say I discovered and developed. It sounds better than conjured up or what was the other?
Concocted.
Concocted, thank you. I didn't invent this molecule. It's been around since the 1950s, and it's used actually as an industrial chemical in lots of things even today. But it has really valuable characteristics, one of which is that it is an inhibitor of an enzyme called acetylcholinesterase, and I'll call it ACHE, or cholinesterase. And this is related to Alzheimer's disease because there are three cardinal neurological changes that happen in Alzheimer's disease. And I've already mentioned two of them, and that is that you form the amyloid plaque that is made up with beta amyloid, which has been a target for Alzheimer's research for 20 or 30 years. You get the neurofibrillary tangles. And the third thing is that the brain area that makes acetylcholine is destroyed early in the disease process. It degenerates. The Alzheimer's disease actually causes a neurodegenerative process that kills the ability of the brain to make a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And acetylcholine is necessary for cognitive processing and memory. It is absolutely critical. It is so critical that if you don't have acetylcholine, you can't remember anything. It just is that clear. It's a key.
Can you measure that in a blood test?
No, you can't measure that in a blood test. Acetylcholine is has a very fleeting short life in the brain. It is produced by the neurons in the brain to serve learning and memory. And in a matter of microseconds, it is dumped out into the synapse, the gap between neurons, to successfully communicate. And then it's destroyed by acetylcholinesterase, or ACHE. So when you don't have enough acetylcholine to start with, because Alzheimer's has destroyed the ability to make it in sufficient quantities, you can amplify the effect of acetylcholine by blocking the enzyme that destroys it.
Okay.
By blocking acetylcholinesterase.
And why do we have then this enzyme to destroy it? Because otherwise your head would just be buzzing with information. Is that?
Well, it's even worse than that, Keith. It's like a telephone a call, you have to make the call, then you have to hang up to make another telephone call. And if you leave acetylcholine out in the synapse uncontrolled, it's like leaving the phone off the hook and it won't function.
Okay.
It just locks it up. So it has to be destroyed very quickly by acetylcholinesterase. So a strategy for making people more functional, for restoring learning and memory ability, is to take a cholinesterase inhibitor, an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, an ACHE inhibitor. The problem with this is that acetylcholine also runs most of the other parts of your body. It runs all of the autonomic nervous system, all of the autonomic ganglia in the peripheral nervous system operate on acetylcholine, and the synapse between the central nervous system and smooth muscle in the parasympathetic part of it runs on acetylcholine. Acetylcholine paces your heart. It does all these things. So when you start inhibiting acetylcholinesterase, you start screwing around with a lot of, and that's a technical term. I'm not just throwing it out here, screwing around with a lot of other functions.
I like
body.
It as a technical term.
Yeah.
This is very informative.
But what attracted me to this drug, MSF, methane sulfonyl fluoride, is that it reacts in the brain to an extremely high level and not so much in the peripheral nervous system. So you can take it in any dose you want to take. You can really get into the therapeutic window. The other drugs cannot be.
So why is it more effective in one locale than another?
Well, it's MSF is an irreversible inhibitor of the enzyme, which means that when MSF reacts with the enzyme, it kills that protein molecule. And the only way that the system can overcome MSF inhibition is by making new acetylcholinesterase, by manufacturing in the cell new enzyme and transporting it out to the outer membrane of the neuron, and then it can recover function. That's a process that takes place with a half-time of about 1 day in the peripheral tissues, and it takes place with 12 days in the brain. So what happens is that the MSF-induced inhibition of ACHE accumulates in the brain to a very high level, and the inhibition in the peripheral tissues simply melts away very quickly every day because the new enzyme is made and there's no deficit that's built up in the peripheral tissue.
So why aren't we taking MSF today to?
Well, Russ, you have to go through the FDA approval process, and that takes probably a minimum of $500 million to $1 billion to get a drug approved. If I started today, it would cost probably in the range of $1 billion.
So then let's go back. You came over to the chemistry department. You talked to these three excellent chemists. You've got some of this material made. They purified it to the standards because you're going to use it with real people. You came over to chemistry, three fine chemists. They give you this material. They purify it to the level needed for human consumption. And then what happened? Well, we'll take a break first, and then we'll learn when you come back. This is Keith Pannell talking with Russ Chianelli, Don Moss, Professor of Psychology, Emeritus, and we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Don Moss. And so, Don, you've now got this nice, pure, liquid material, MSF. What did you do with it?
Well, first of all, I went over to the chemistry department to see if MSF was the best compound that could be made. It was a prototype. And so I worked with Bill Herndon and Steve Vincente to synthesize about 65 alternative molecules that had to be tested to see if I could get a better one. And that wasted about 2 years because MSF, my beginning material, was the best by about 100-fold compared to all the others.
And that was pure guesswork on your part?
It's what I discovered first, and then I decided, well, maybe it could work better. Okay. Maybe I could add something to it or change it and get a molecule that's even better. But they were very helpful. They got me some pure MSF. Eventually, I actually had some manufactured commercially to meet the FDA standards. It had to be documented, which we did not do in the chemistry department. And I went to Mexico. I met a investigator in Mexico that was very interested in MSF. Dr. Patricia Berlanga in Ciudad Chihuahua is a geriatrician that has a clinic down there. She is very interested in MSF. So I went down there with a research team, and we recruited patients. We got approval, by the way, through the university and through the Mexican drug regulatory authorities. It was all above board. It's not a matter of running it out of somebody's garage or one of those things. And I had FDA-approved material, met the quality standards, went down there, and I worked in Mexico for a year. And I ran a phase one trial, which is where you give the drug to normal humans to see if it's toxic, to ask them, you know, did you have an adverse event? You can't do this with demented people that might be patients because they're not good informants. They don't remember if they were sick that morning, and they don't remember anything about what happened.
And if I remember correctly, just to sort of add to this, you actually took some of this material yourself.
Oh, I took it myself before. I thought that a possibility would develop in Mexico, so I decided I've got to take it myself. I had gone down to Argentina a few years before that and tried to set it up, and one of the questions that I kept being asked while I was down in Argentina is, you know, have you taken this drug yourself? Are we the first ones? And I heard the term conejillos de indias over and over and over again, which is Spanish for guinea pigs, or as close to Spanish as I can get. They didn't want to be guinea pigs, and so I knew that if I was going to develop the opportunity in Mexico that I would have to take it myself, and so I did. And I took it over several months, and I took it up to some very high doses, high enough, higher than is what's necessary for therapeutic use. And I had a local physician here at the insistence of my dear, loving wife, Joanne, who has put up with this for years and years. She said, yes, I'll let you do that if you'll be under medical supervision. So I went to my doctor, and he said he'd supervise me, and I did that. But I want to add to the story that when I got home, I had a colleague that said, do not test cholinesterase inhibitors on dogs because they're really sensitive to this. ACHE inhibitors are very toxic to dogs, very sensitive. So don't try it. And I thought, oh, this is backwards because I want to know if it's toxic. I want to know if it's going to have bad effects. So I think dogs would be an ideal model. If you want to know the truth, do it on dogs. So this is after I'd done it on myself.
Did they forget to bark?
But this was after I'd done it on myself. I went home to Joanne and I said, you know, we had this lovely golden Labrador retriever, and really compliant, and I could draw blood from her and everything. And I said, Joanne, I want to run this experiment that I've already done on myself. I want to run it on the dog. And she said, absolutely not. She would let me do it to myself.
Absolutely, but not to the golden retriever.
But the bottom line is I lived in Mexico for a year, and Dr. Berlanga and I ran very successful phase one and phase two clinical trials.
Distinguished phase one is the safety. Phase two is
when we actually give it to patients.
Right, and measure their responses.
And we saw patients get better on it down there. It wasn't one of these studies where you had to run 1,000 people for 6 months and then statistically you could tell the difference. Patients would get better right before our eyes, and the families knew. It was a double-blind study so that they did not know. I did not tell them if they were going to be on drug or placebo. And they knew they were on drug when their family members started getting better and recovering function.
There was no placebo effect at all in this.
Well, there might have been a placebo effect in the placebo group.
I mean, was there? I mean, that's a question.
Yes. Well, you always get a placebo effect. I mean,
that amazing?
It is.
Right.
Well, and some of the placebo effect comes from the family members that hope that their patient is getting better, and so they're too quick to. But there's a big difference between thinking that you might see improvement and behavioral things where people actually get better. They get up in the morning and they start taking care of themselves instead of being in bed all day, having somebody to take them to the toilet, stuff like that.
Russell? Well, I remember working on this where we were trying to put it on a clay. Why? Slow release?
Well, we wanted a slow release, but we also wanted to get a patent. The big stumbling block for the development of this whole drug has been the patent, and I applied for a patent in 1996. It was eventually issued in 1998 when I had a big drug company, a big European drug company interested in it, and it would have taken off at that point and probably be in use today. The big drug company found that the patent that had been developed by the University of Texas system was defective, and the patent was no good. The drug company lost interest. We had to get the patent reexamined. We lost 2 years, and those 2 years might as well have been dog years, because then interest in the drug waned over those 2 years, and when we started out with it again, it was licensed to a small biotech company that went broke, one thing and another.
And of course, when you get a patent, you've only got a lifetime of, what, 20 years or something
Back then, they changed the regulations as you go along. Now you get a 17-year window from the day it's issued. But back then, you got 20 years from the day of the application. So that was 1996. And all of my patents worldwide expired in 2016.
Well, the other thing I'm reading right now is that a lot of, the virtual stuff is saying that Alzheimer's is a virus.
Well, that's one hypothesis, and a virus might be one of the triggers for it. But if that's true, it's not something you have to worry about catching. It's not. If it's true, a virus, all of us are exposed to it and probably have the virus, and those that have other predisposing factors are the ones that get Alzheimer's. But before we run out of time, I want to talk about cholinesterase inhibitors. And there's been some really recent evidence data were developed by some people in Paris that did some great experiments. And they actually did experiments where they took a group of patients, and they randomly assigned them. It was a randomized controlled trial. In clinical research like this, this is really high level. Most of the time, we just watch patients and see if they get better, and it's not really controlled. This was a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial in Paris where they took some people that are prodromal Alzheimer's. Prodromal Alzheimer's means that they're in cognitive impairment. They're suffering cognitive problems, and they have all the signs of developing Alzheimer's. And even though we can't be sure, we're 90% sure they're going to get Alzheimer's. And they did high-resolution MRI on three areas of the brain that are critical in Alzheimer's. The basal forebrain, which is where the acetylcholine-producing cells are that get destroyed. They did it in the hippocampus, which is the area of the brain that's deeply involved in memory, and, of course, the cortex, which is memory and higher cognitive functioning. They did high-resolution MRI, and half of the people got a low-level, currently available drug, cholinesterase inhibitor, that is only marginally effective to start with, for 1 year, and they found that being on a cholinesterase inhibitor for as little as 1 year slowed the rate of atrophy. They slowed the rate of shrinkage of the brain. The disease caused destruction of the brain over 1 year. Now, this is a big breakthrough because this is on top of 20 years of working on beta amyloid. And every single one of 400 plus clinical trials over the last 20 years on amyloid have failed. And so to get a drug that was originally introduced only to treat memory problems on a day-to-day basis might actually be changing the underlying rate of the disease progression, that it's actually slowing the disease progression. And someday we might start taking a cholinesterase inhibitor at 55 years old, like you might take a low-dose aspirin, to just facilitate the brain resistance, and it will stay
the normal age-related memory impairment, it will reduce that, and it will reduce the progression of Alzheimer's.
So you're of a certain age. You don't have any symptoms. But since you've taken this material of yours once before, does this encourage you to think, well, now this MRI study from Paris is pretty much vindication of the fact that this is an approach?
Absolutely.
And so you're going to start nipping a little bit of this every day?
And nipping it on the side.
Right. And what stops people doing that? The government in the U.S. just passed this right to choose law.
Well,
there are right to try.
There are daily memory devices that you can take. I can't remember the name.
Well, but they are not. Most of them are just BS, frankly. Most of the things that are not, well, you see, I forget the names of these trade names, but they make claims that are really marginal.
Can you think then of this material being actually as a supplement? Because supplements are not particularly well regulated.
That's right. But MSF doesn't fit the standard of a supplement because it's not a normal material in the body that you're increasing, and it really is well defined as a drug under FDA regulations.
So it's already been described as a drug.
Yes,
because of your work.
Well, and
or was it out there before?
Because of its mechanism of action,
yeah.
And it's a synthetic chemical.
So what are you doing about this now? What do we have to look forward to?
Well, right now, because this is really an exciting time, because everybody has pretty much, well, not everybody, but most of the big drug companies have thrown in the towel on chasing the amyloid hypothesis. That's been like a religion. Everybody's worked on amyloid, and we now have gotten that out of the way. We know that you're not going to be successful with it.
And anyway, that may be the end product.
It's a marker.
It's
a marker for the disease. Pfizer, for example, has thrown over its whole Alzheimer's program. And it has gotten out of the Alzheimer's drug development business because of the frustration. But they have given their technology, that's an accumulation of 30 years of work, to a entity that's being formed between the people from Pfizer that worked on Alzheimer's and Bain Capital, which is the getting money is the other important part of developing a drug. And they're looking around for a new strategy for treating Alzheimer's. And by far the best data that we've ever – this is by far the best data we've ever had on a drug that can slow the progression of the disease has never been documented before.
And so
it's a real – it's opening a new door.
And this is just when you're retiring
from
the
university. Just when I'm ready to go for it.
And you're still working on it.
And they have formed a new company called Cerevel, C-E-R-E-V-E-L. And I have submitted information to Cerevel saying, I have a drug that's five times better than what's available on the market. The drug that did this in Paris, my drug is much better than that. And they may... they may pick it up and we can go for it from there. But this is an exciting time in Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. And you're right there in the forefront. So, Don Moss, thank you so much for being back here on Science Studio. And God willing, you may come back in 10 more years and tell us exactly where Cerevel and your material went.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, and thank the listeners out there for being here again this week. Bye-bye.